The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, I have nothing on my mind. I could try to talk about how great that is, but I don't even know what to say. It is great, but So I thought maybe the wisest thing to do is to hear if you have any questions that you know, or issues or topics you'd like to raise, and maybe we can have a conversation, or I could try to respond. In the back there, just a minute. Wait for the mic, please.
Hold it close.
Yeah, I was reading in the schedule that you gave a talk, I think Sunday and Monday, about the natural world. I'm not sure what the topic was.
Yeah.
So I wasn't here for those, and maybe everyone else was, but I don't know if there's anything more that you have to say about that subject.
Yeah, thank you. Well, this week is Earth Care Week, which is the week that there was an international meeting of Insight meditation teachers and talking about climate change and all that, and the decision was made for the different centers around to celebrate 1 week a year, the first week of October, and that's now morphed into the first week starting with the first Sunday in October. And so I gave talks on those topics. And if I had been a little bit able to have something on my mind, that would have been a great topic for today. So you've evoked it, so thank you. And there's a long tradition, or part of our tradition that we've come out of is that in Thailand is the Thai forest tradition. There's a long tradition of Buddhist monastics practicing living in the forest, and with a very clear understanding that that forest life supports Buddhist practice. I met a wonderful Buddhist monk many years ago named Mahagusananda. He was one of the few Cambodian monks who survived the Pol Pot genocide, partly because he was in Thailand during that time. And so he went back to, after the Pol Pot times, went back to Cambodia and became kind of like the, well, he became the spiritual leader of Cambodia. And a wonderful man. As people said, he's kind of like the Mahatma Gandhi of Cambodia or something. And I met him once. I think it was breakfast together. We met, and old man, and he was talking about how he was involved in tree planting in Cambodia. And so I was young and maybe a little bit too bold. And I said to him, what are you doing? You know, you're a senior monk of Buddhism in all of Cambodia. What are you doing spending your time planting trees? And it was a little bit, I wanted to find the answer. I mean, it was kind of like way of asking a question. And he looked at me very kindly and he said, because the Buddha was born under a tree, was enlightened under a tree, and died under a tree. And so his idea is that, I think that he saw that trees in nature were intimately part of the Buddha's awakening, our connection to the natural world, is really speaks to or touches or the kind of intimacy and freedom and liberation in this world of change and the world of phenomena that we find ourselves in. And when people lose touch with the natural world, then it's much more difficult to find their inner freedom and find their, the goodness that's within. So the natural world and Buddhism, I'd like to think of going hand in hand. So that's what occurs to me impromptu with your... Thank you.
So when you have something that's particularly compelling on your mind, it's very difficult to let go of. And you want to be in the place that you described in your earlier talk about, you know, about being really with the present, but it's just very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. Do you have any particular suggestions about how to manage that? And
well, kind of building on what I said this morning, I've never done this, but, you know, I'm just making it up, but see if it works for you. So you're very much involved in a concern, preoccupation. It should happen maybe once in a while. And then imagine that, you know, kind of stop and kind of look at what you're doing and imagine that you really only have about 5 more minutes to be alive as a human being. This is like it. Is this what you want to do with your time? Is this like what's most important? Does that give you a different perspective on what your preoccupation is and how you're involved in it? What happens if you do that? And if you can get into that exercise, maybe that'll change your perspective about what's most important. Because I think there's a certain percentage of people's preoccupations which are not really worth it. A certain percentage.
For me, it's not preoccupation, it's just curiosity.
Uh-huh.
I was just wondering, like, the monastic community, why they would depend on alms food instead of, planting their own food.
Mm. In China and in Japan, the Buddhist monastic communities evolved, so they do that. And there's a saying in China, in Chinese monasteries, a day without work is a day without food. So there's a lot of places they do it. But the Buddhism of India, they didn't do that. Because the idea was that they were supposed to be able to freed up from that kind of livelihood thing, which back in ancient India took a lot of time and effort to grow your own food, so they can devote themselves to spiritual practice and be available to teach to people. They're kind of like they're specialists, right? It's like, you know, we have doctors here at the local hospitals, and why don't we expect them to grow their food? You know, we want them to keep focused, you know. Time for surgery, well, you know, I have to weed the garden. So I think to be able to specialize and really focus, the other reason is that that for monastics, there is a kind of, this is maybe a little difficult to say, maybe I won't say it accurately, but there's a desire among monastics to live by a very high ethical standard. And it's hard in a lot of livelihoods to have that high ethical standard. There's often compromises made one way or the other. So it's not the livelihood, but an example would be driving a car. Monastics don't drive cars because if you drive a car, inevitably you're going to squash some insect. And so they don't want to be involved in being part of that world of squashing insects. So they ask someone to drive them. So that doesn't quite make sense, but... you know, but the idea is, and so the idea of back in ancient India or growing your own food, there's a lot of destruction happens with, digging the soil and killing the worms and doing all that. So the idea is to try to minimize their impact, and that's part of it. And the other is that, which is I think a fascinating idea, is that when you rely on alms from people, then you're in a mutual interdependent relationship. You're in communication with them, and there's a feedback loop. If you go off and live in some isolated place and grow your own food and take care of yourself, you're not in a symbiotic or a healthy relationship with the flow with people around you, and you don't get feedback. And so this way, there's this exchange. So the lay people provide the food for the monastics, support them, and the monastic provide teachings and provide the example of their lifestyle and their ethics and their practice and meditation. And the lay people provide food to give people a chance to really specialize and delve in. Remember, in ancient India, there weren't retreat centers. You know, there weren't meditation places like this. I mean, And people didn't have vacation time to go off on retreats. And you know, you really had to do a radical lifestyle shift to be able to do intensive practice that's kind of unimaginable for us, where we have, at least in our luxurious life, we can take time off and things. But in that exchange, then, if the monastics weren't behaving properly, the feedback was instant, or that day, because then the lay people wouldn't want to give them food. If they were self-sufficient with livelihood, then they would be oblivious. They would be able to continue without getting any feedback. But the feedback's, you know, right there. And so it is that's part of the logic of it. Those are some ideas I have about it. You want to ask more, or is that satisfying? Okay.
Okay. When you sit cross-legged like that for a really long time, uh-huh. Do your legs get numb and you're just ignoring?
Do they get what?
Do they get numb and you're just ignoring them, or do they stop getting numb after a while?
Oh, they seldom get numb for me now. They did when I started, which is many very common people when they start. And very occasionally they will now, usually because I'm sitting a little bit funny and something's being pinched or something. But it's pretty rare now that they fall asleep or get numb. But, you know, it's a common thing. Generally it goes away after a few weeks if you do this regularly. That's usually what happens. The guideline is that don't get up quickly. And we had one person break her foot, little bones in her foot, because she stood up without having her foot being able to support herself, and she fell down on it. And so meditation can be dangerous. And so be sure you have a sensation coming back. But if the sensation doesn't come back within 2 or 3 minutes, then probably you're pinching a nerve. You have to kind of shake your leg and massage it, right? If it doesn't come back in 2 or 3 minutes, then you're probably pinching a nerve, and you never want to do that, because that can cause lasting damage. So never sit that way and have that kind of numbness again. Okay, so I saw one more. To Rebecca.
Thank you. I'm trying to understand the balance between daily life practice and intensive retreat practice for the purpose of letting go of attachment. Can you address that a little?
It's a great question. And I might not have the right answer for you or to most people, but I put a tremendous amount of trust in the intuition around this topic. For me, that's what I've relied on. At some point, there was this pull, this internal intuition, and this feeling, oh, it's time to go on retreat. This is where the work is. And then when I finished the retreat, I'm not doing a retreat again for a while now. You know, I felt this, you know, and so then I would live my life. And then at some point, I get this feeling I'm ready again, and that this seems important again. And there are times when really, the motivation to be on retreat was very, very powerful. But I could give logic to it, you know, reasons why that was the case. But it was something deeper that was really flowing through me and operating. So I kind of trust this inner guidance that is provided rather than any ideas of how you do that. And so it means mindfulness, tuning in, and really feeling what the pull is, or feeling what feels really right, really right. And then trial and error also works well. So you can't necessarily have the right answer for yourself, even with the intuition. So you have to be willing to do some trial and error. And so try one direction out to the other a little bit and see what the feedback is. And so try daily life for a while, and then after a little while, like 3 minutes, you find out, I should go on retreat. or go and retreat, and then at the end of that, she said, well, that was good, but you know, I really was avoiding things I should have been staying home and practicing with. So anyway, so it's all kind of, all this different criteria, different information comes back, different ways unfold over time, provide all the data that somehow lets the inner life process and give you some direction from intuition. That's my way. Great. So thank you very much. So